You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 29th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's programme...
He decidido seguir. Seguir con más fuerza, si cabe, al frente de la presidencia del gobierno de España.
Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez declares that he will not quit. Scottish First Minister Humza Yousaf announces his decision about whether or not he will quit. Later in the show, Ukraine withdraws from three villages in occupied Donetsk, noting that fresh supplies of ammunition haven't got there yet, and...
The connections between Austrian politics and Russia were already very close before the conservative right-wing coalition, and it started with the Conservative Party.
A report on the spy scandal engulfing the politics of Austria. That's all coming up right here on The Briefing on Monocle Radio. And welcome to today's edition of The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. Despite the United States passing of a long-delayed aid package for Ukraine last week, the shortages for which the delay was partially responsible are continuing to have an effect on the battlefield. Colonel General Oleksandr Syrsky, Commander-in-Chief of Ukraine's armed forces, acknowledged over the weekend that his troops had made tactical retreats from three villages in Donetsk Oblast. Syrsky specifically cited a shortage of supplies. Well, I'm joined with more on this by Alex Kocharov, a Russia-Ukraine analyst at S&P Global Market Intelligence. Alex, first of all, how significant actually is this withdrawal? What is Ukraine giving up here?
Well, Ukraine announced that they were withdrawing from three villages which are located west of Avdiivka. And since Avdiivka was captured by the Russians back in February this year, Ukrainians have lost eight villages west of the now Russian-controlled city. So it does sound a lot, but again, you know, it's been eight villages in 2 months, which means four villages per month, approximately a village per week. So I wouldn't call that, I wouldn't say that the front line is collapsing for the Ukrainian forces, despite the fact that there are shortages both in terms of personnel and military equipment.
I mean, Syrsky was very careful to position this, perhaps unsurprisingly, as a tactical retreat. But in terms of those shortages that you mention of both ammunition and personnel, is it clear yet when the new material unleashed by the aid bill and indeed the new personnel who might be called up under the revised mobilization laws might start to make a difference?
The military supplies will probably start having a difference in the coming weeks, because there is already evidence that some of the U.S. Military supplies are coming into Ukraine as we speak. U.S. armed forces have prepositioned some types of weapons and ammunition in Europe at their bases in Germany and elsewhere. So it's not going to take a lot of time for at least some of the artillery shells or air defense weapons to be delivered to the front lines. In terms of personnel, the impact of the mobilization law, which was approved in April, is not going to be felt probably, I would say, earliest July, if not August, September, because it will only become effective on 17th of May. And it will take time first to recruit people and then to train them at least several weeks. So the personnel deficiencies, the numbers of personnel are going to be not sufficient for the Ukrainians in the coming several months at least.
If we look at this from the other lines, i.e. from behind Russia's, is it possible that one reason that they are pouring more resources into this and trying to create some offensive momentum is that they know that their time is limited before these fresh resources arrive for Ukraine?
Yes, absolutely. We've seen statements from senior Ukrainian military commanders that Russia has been intensifying offensive operations along the entire front line. So it's not just limited to areas west of Avdiivka, but also near Kupiansk, near Liman, in Zaporizhia region and elsewhere. And Russians are fully aware that there will be another wave of mobilization in Ukraine. So later in the year, there will be more troops. U.S. have approved this significant package, which gives Ukrainians sufficient weapons, at least for defensive operations, if not for limited offensives, for at least this year. And also, we need to remember that the F-16 aircraft, fighter jets, which were announced last year, are likely to come to Ukraine at some point this summer, perhaps as early as June. And it means that Russians would no longer enjoy the air superiority along the front line they are having now. So they understand that the window of opportunity is closing for them, and they're trying to capture as much land as possible now before Ukrainians are better placed to defend their current positions.
General Sierski also trying to announce some good news. This is in Kherson Oblast rather than Donetsk, but he's talking about the capture of an island in the Dnipro River Delta. Is this actually a big deal, or is this the Ukrainians trying to advance the one bit of good news they have this weekend?
I think it's more of a tactical development rather than a strategic. Ukrainians have established several bridgeheads on the left, meaning Russian-controlled parts of the Dnieper River bank back at the end of last year. And the heavy fighting over those bridgeheads has been ongoing. So the fact that Ukrainians are capturing more territory in the Dnieper Delta, including some of the islands, is tactically important, but it's not going to be sufficient for a successful large-scale offensive operations, because Ukrainians would be quite unlikely to be able to transport any heavy armor across the river, as it would be too dangerous to do so.
Alex Kokhturov at S&P Global Market Intelligence, thanks for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing. Here is Carlotta Ribello with the day's other headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. A Hamas delegation is in Egypt today, where it will respond to Israel's latest proposal for a truce in Gaza and hostage release after almost 7 months of war. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, on his seventh visit to the region since the October 7 Hamas attack, arrived today in Saudi Arabia and will also travel to Israel and neighboring Jordan later this week. At least 35 people have been killed and dozens of others are missing after a dam burst in southern Kenya, sweeping away homes and vehicles as the country grapples with weeks of heavy rains and devastating flash floods. The incident comes as flooding has inundated large swathes of Kenya, killing at least 103 people and forcing thousands of residents from their homes since March. And the South Korean government says it will deploy additional medical personnel to maintain healthcare services as medical professionals are due to resign or take weekly breaks starting this week. Treatments include essential medical procedures that need to be performed immediately on patients with severe heart conditions. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Carlotta. This is The Briefing on Monocle Radio, and Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez has at last responded to several days of speculation about his future by deciding that he will, on reflection, stay in his post. The brouhaha had been occasioned by the opening of an investigation into accusations of corruption involving his wife, Begoña Gómez. Sanchez has dismissed the allegations as a politically motivated witch hunt and appears to have an ally in Madrid's public prosecutor, who has called for the probe to be called off due to lack of evidence. Well, I'm joined with more on this by Liam Aldous, Monocle's Madrid correspondent. Liam, first of all, was this broadly the decision people expected the Prime Minister to make?
Well, apparently not. Apparently close sources to the Prime Minister, even on Saturday, didn't really know which way this would go. There was not the speculation in the press was that he was going to opt out and opt for a job in the EU, where he would probably have like a more of a calmer time. But the country was on edge this morning. I mean, I myself was on a moto sitting in the rain to listen to the decision. So it really could have gone either way. But he has announced that he will stay. And now that you look at it in retrospect, it looks like, you know, maybe this was a little bit of a political strategy to refocus attention on his government, the worth of his government, and to really like seize the political debate and get the attention off of his wife and onto himself. He did mention in his letter to the entire country 6 days ago that he profoundly loved his wife and he wanted to protect her, and the 10 years of political attacks have really gotten to him. So we were all wondering whether he would go or he would stay, but he's obviously announced he will stay.
So how did he actually frame it? Was this the resolute but determined speech? Was it the slightly contrite speech, or did he come out swinging?
It was resolute and determined. He didn't really come out swinging. And a lot of the initial criticism after the speech is that he didn't. He basically said that we need as a country to decide what kind of country we want to be, whether attacks on politicians' wives and family members are going to be permitted. But he didn't really include any proposals or ideas about how he was going to, you know, reframe this debate. He said it was time for a reset, time for new politics, but didn't have any proposals. His speech was only 8 minutes, so there wasn't much in there. But Pedro Sanchez is the king of the comeback. He's been ousted by his party before, and then he went around the country to rouse up support, and then he was reinstated. He's been called the Spanish political phoenix. So this was just another way that Sanchez has kept everyone guessing, and he's, I guess, in his mind is also thinking of the Catalan regional elections, which are in 2 weeks. So once again, he's reframed the debate around the value of the Socialist Party in Spain, and particularly Catalonia. And he's also thinking about the European elections, which are in about a month's time as well.
Is there clarity as such regarding what his wife is actually accused of?
Not really. I mean, manos limpias, which is a very, you know, suspicious, murky organization which is connected to the far right and has used lawfare a lot to attack political candidates across the spectrum, but mainly on the left, came out today and said that, first of all, their evidence is a little bit shaky. I saw some of the supposed evidence, and it's two-bit journalists sitting in front of a computer reading out a Word document of a apparent transcription of Sanchez's wife trying to use her husband's political position for economic favors. But there's no recordings, there's nothing that, you know, there's no smoking gun. But Manos Limpias came out after the speech and said they have more evidence, and over the next few days they're going to release more evidence that implicate Pedro Sanchez. So as Sanchez said in his speech, he doesn't expect this campaign against his wife or against him to end, but he's really focusing the debate around, you know, what is allowed in Spanish democracy, and he's probably going to have to try and get some of the opposition, especially the more center-right party, on board for a political agreement to refocus that debate. But apparently he hasn't spoken to the opposition leader Feijóo in months, so, you know, that also says a lot about the quality of Spanish democracy at the moment.
I mean, leaving aside those alleged pending new allegations, from where we're standing now, does this actually seem like something a politician calls a politically motivated witch hunt might actually be a politically motivated witch hunt?
Yeah, I mean, I think Spanish politics, one of the constants is that there's a lot of politically motivated witch hunts. There's a lot of dirty games. I mean, this isn't something new. And I think that the fact that, like, Pedro Sanchez said, enough is enough, and, you know, he basically disappeared for 5 days, which is, it was a very strange time, and, you know, there was a lot of, you know, like, the country was on edge. I mean, you could look at some of the reactions that have come out today. Even the Catalan regional leader has said that, you know, it was basically a complete overacting campaign, and he just was completely out of line. But I don't know. I think I don't expect the quality of the debate to improve. But the problem is that the rise of the far right in Spain has led the center right party to try and match them at their game, which has kind of like dragged everyone down. So that's the big problem here. It's a question of whether the center right wants to change their politics of shame, as Sanchez calls it, or wants to keep battling for superiority between the far right and the center right.
I mean, obviously, when a prime minister goes off grid for 5 days amid speculation about whether he's staying or not, that is going to be a big story. But can you give us some flavor of the coverage across Spanish media, who presumably have been having the absolute time of their lives with this?
Yeah, they were definitely having the times of their lives across the spectrum too. I mean, I think the more like left-wing media, where there was a lot of speculation, you know, a lot of talk about nothing, filling airtime basically. But on the right side of media, the conservative side of media, there was a lot more attacks on Sanchez, saying, you know, once again he's made this whole country's debate about the whole country about himself. He's navel gazing. You know, they really like amped up the attacks on him. And keep in mind that the mood of politics in Spain at the moment is quite tense. I mean, there's protests against the Socialist Party headquarters every weekend. Hundreds, if not thousands, of people. Sanchez, every time he appears in public, is yelled at and screamed and interrupted with his speeches, you know, which is, you know, becoming also a constant. I saw a description the other day that said, you know, there's all this talk of two Spains. There's the Rojos, the red Spain, and the left Spain and the right Spain. But then this comment said, you know, but there's also a third Spain, which is the amount of people that have had it up to their heads with both Spains, you know. So there's like not just a division, there's also people who are checking out completely or just tired of the level of tension and attacks that are in Spanish politics.
Liam Aldous in Madrid, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. And you are back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio with me, Andrew Muller, and sticking with the subject of leaders of European nations keeping their fellow citizens guessing vis-a-vis their intentions of staying or going, Scotland's embattled, if not downright beleaguered, First Minister Hamza Youssef has been speaking as we have been on air. His minority Scottish National Party government fell out with its semi-detached Green Party partners last week, prompting a motion of no confidence. Well, I'm joined now by Nadine Batchelor-Hunt, political reporter for Politics Home. Nadine, is he staying or going?
He's going, and it was expected that this would happen. It was briefed a lot over the weekend that his position was untenable, essentially when he decided that the power-sharing agreement with the Green Party wasn't going to go ahead anymore. And essentially, he's not particularly popular in the Scottish Parliament, so his government essentially has collapsed in many ways, and he's going now. And it will be interesting to see who his successor will be, and I imagine it will be a pretty fraught contest. But in terms of who this is best news for, obviously it's bad news for the SNP, but it's great news for Labour, who are seeking to make some inroads at the next general election in Scotland, because they obviously lost many seats in Scotland over the last few decades. And they want to get this massive majority at the next election. So if they can kind of play up this SNP chaos and get voters in Scotland to turn back to Labour, then this is very good news for the Labour Party.
There's a lot there I do want to come back to, but first of all, to the First Minister's statement, how did he actually frame it? What did he say?
So he framed it very much as, you know, saying he was quite proud of the fact that he had been, you know, the first Asian leader of Scotland, and that basically his position had become untenable and he wanted to find a replacement as soon as possible. And as I said, it was widely expected over the weekend that his position was untenable. It wasn't a matter of will he stand down, it was a matter of when will he stand down. And obviously he's chosen today to do it, and right in the middle of a local election campaign with votes on Thursday. So as I said, it's great timing for opposition parties in Scotland who want to see the SNP gone.
I mean, it is an extraordinary situation for the SNP to have gotten itself into, given that well within living memory, like in just the last few years, it looked like they had locked Scotland up as essentially a one-party state. Where did it all go wrong?
Well, this is exactly it. And I think, you know, Nicola Sturgeon was almost a force of nature in Scottish politics. And I think when she left, it did feel like very much the end of an era. And obviously, since then, there's been various police investigations into the SNP concerning a kind of like an electioneering bust about whether the funds should have been used for the SNP or for the independence campaigns. There's an ongoing police investigation there. I think Nicola Sturgeon's husband was arrested a few weeks ago. But Nicola Sturgeon really was the kind of the face of the SNP in Scotland, and she was a very formidable opponent. And I think, you know, whether or not politicians on different sides of politics liked her, I think they could recognise that she was a force to be reckoned with. But with her departure, it does feel that the SNP have lost that kind of that headstrong surety that they had under her. And since Hamza Yousaf has come in, it has felt like their position has weakened somewhat, and they're not doing as well in the polls. Labour projected to start picking up seats at the next general election in Scotland again. So it does feel that the kind of SNP's meteoric kind of rise was very much linked in many ways to Nicola Sturgeon. Since she's gone, the party really has had a lot of woes that they're struggling to overcome.
Well, we are, of course, obviously in what is, I guess, the very first minutes of the leadership campaign to succeed Hamza Yousaf as leader of the SNP. Do any plausible candidates seem likelier than any others?
So it's difficult to say this early on. Obviously, people haven't really declared themselves or ran campaigns, but I think there's been some interesting speculation about whether or not Stephen Flynn, who is the Westminster leader in Parliament, could be the replacement. He's a good communicator, but I think I don't think people have announced who will be running yet. But I imagine, as we saw with his campaign, it's going to be a tough competition. There's going to be a lot of people jockeying for that position. But I ultimately think anybody is going to struggle to tap into that magic that Nicola Sturgeon had. As I said, whether or not you liked or not, she definitely managed to kind of capture that the kind of Scottish tension in a way that I think her predecessor struggled.
So what happens once a leader is chosen? Because they still face fundamentally the same problem that Hamza Yousaf did, which is that they do not have a parliamentary majority in Scotland. Is the assumption that it was just all about him and that somebody else will be able to assemble some kind of majority, or might they have to put this to Scotland's people?
I think that's ultimately it. I think what will happen now, obviously, there'll be a leadership election because the SNP need a leader of the SNP, given they're the biggest party in Hollywood. But yeah, if they can't form a government, then there will be an election. And I imagine there'll be many MPs or MSPs who would rather see that, particularly Labour, as I said, because they'll likely pick up quite a few seats. So, you know, whoever wins, it's a bit of a poison chalice because there's a lot of there's a lot of distrust and a lot of animosity towards the SNP, and particularly over things like their recent hate crime law, which there was a lot of row over that because of the position it took on trans hate crimes, with JK Rowling famously taking on Hamza Yousaf over that. So there's a lot of frustration with the SNP in the Scottish government. So whoever replaces Hamza Yousaf is still going to have to grapple with this growing unpopularity of the SNP and hostility, and ultimately run a minority government, which is a really difficult task, even if you have MSPs that have a more favourable opinion of you.
Nadine Batchelor-Hunt with Politics Home, thank you as always for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. This is The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Austria has of late been grappling with one of the biggest espionage scandals in its history. This began in late March when Austrian authorities arrested a former high-ranking intelligence officer, Egisto Ott, on suspicion of spying for Russia. Ott is also suspected of passing sensitive information to another Austrian, Jan Marsalek, a former senior manager at the collapsed German payment processing giant Wirecard, who is now allegedly in hiding in Russia. The story is deeply embarrassing for the Austrian government, which has called for tighter controls on espionage since news of Ott's arrest became public. The affair could also have big consequences for Austrian elections this autumn. Monocle's Alexei Korolev in Vienna reports.
In the strange dark world of espionage, very little is known for certain, and anyone can be a double agent. In the case of Egisto Ott, he was first suspected of giving away secrets to the Russians in 2017. But the following year, he was reassigned to work in a police academy. He was finally arrested in 2021, but the evidence against him was found to be inconclusive, and so he walked free. It was only last month that he was caught for good.
You can see on this case also how efficient Russia was to infiltrate even our ministries. And also, in general, I hope the discussion will go on the question how much they infiltrated our political system, also in the thinking.
Stephanie Crespo is an MP for the Liberal Party NEOS and its spokesperson on domestic affairs. She says the scandal is a result of sheer incompetence by Austria's main party, the conservative ÖVP, and the right-wing Freedom Party, the FPÖ. Both parties ran the interior ministry when Agista Ort was allegedly passing intelligence to Russia. Both parties, but especially the FPÖ, have long-standing links with Russia themselves. So Stephanie Crespo is now calling for an inquiry.
That means that in the centre of the investigations of the Parliamentary Inquiry Commission should also be the Austrian Russian Friendship Organization that was also initiated years ago from Conservative Party's members and ex-ministers. So the Conservative Party has now an easy game to blame the FPÖ that is now in the focus of this scandal. But in fact, the connections between Austrian politics and Russia were already very close before the conservative right-wing coalition, and it started with the Conservative Party being also more interesting logically for Russia as being the party mainly in power in Austria since the end of the Second World War.
So what did Agista Ort do exactly that got the Austrian authorities so worried? To explain, here's Paul Schliffsteiner, head of the Austrian Center for Intelligence, Propaganda and Security Studies.
Agista Ort worked for the Austrian Domestic Intelligence Service. He used the access he had to databases to do illegal requests and then most likely sold this information. What we also know now, next to this context, most likely to Russian services, Agista Ort seems also have to establish friendly working relation with colleagues within Italy, within Germany and so on. And he used those contacts to also gather international information. The people he requested information on were, many of them were Russian dissidents, even former members of Russian intelligence who defected.
But it wasn't just information that Agista Ort allegedly dealt in. Paul Schliffsteiner again.
He sold one of these Siena laptops, which is a German development, and as I understand it, also only produced in Germany. These are high-security laptops. They are used by NATO, they are used by German intelligence, and I think also by other intelligence services. And as far as we know, one of those laptops found his way to Moscow, and two others were discovered with Mr. Ort when he was arrested.
In 2018, the domestic intelligence agency where Agista Ort had worked was raided by the police. Some of its officers were arrested and accused of mishandling sensitive information. This prompted several countries to restrict the amount of intelligence they were sharing with Vienna. And Paul Schliffsteiner says the Agista Ort case may have the same effect.
The question now is, can the ministry and can the service assure especially European partners that all these problems are problems of the past? Personally, I believe that optics of the whole Ott affair are really not good because it took the Austrian authorities, and I'm not going to blame anyone, but it took the Austrian authorities at least from 2017 to 2024, yeah, to arrest him permanently, to, you know, stop this information flow and so on. And this could lead to a situation where the other services and intelligence agencies are more skeptical.
And what about things closer to home? With the right-wing FPÖ leading in opinion polls, are liberal parties like NEOS going to use the Agista Ort case against them? A last word to NEOS MP Stephanie Crespa.
Well, I think it's important to let the voter know whom he or she will support when electing a certain party. But I also think it's a double game and double speak by the Conservative Party to only blame the FPÖ, because the infiltration of our Ministry of Interior was possible in the time where Conservative ministers were in charge of this very important ministry. And that's why we think a Parliamentary Inquiry Commission would be important to identify the reforms that are important to implement to make such developments impossible in the future.
For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Thank you, Alexei, for that report. And by fabulous happenstance, this coming Saturday's edition of The Foreign Desk is an extended reflection on resigning, especially when you don't really have to. But that is all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Christy O'Grady. Our studio manager was Mariella Bevan. The Briefing returns tomorrow at the same time. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.